What's going on, everybody? Good day to you all, regardless of what day you happen to be listening to this podcast on.
It's a good day because you're listening to this podcast.
That's right. Any day is a good day. To my left, the man that you're hearing over there, he's my undercover brother from another mother. He's a secret agent, man. He is the Q to my 007. It's Professor Adam, ladies and gentlemen, and we're having some fun today. This is a good one. We're going back to a tried and true well. We're going back to World War II. I feel like we've just been there recently. Maybe we have been, but who cares?
Everything's different. The way that World War II is laid out, and I think I've said this before, is it's an onion that just never, you never find the center of it. There's always a different layer. And this whole idea, we did the, I believe it was our seventh episode, one of my all-time favorites on the Ghost Army during World War II.
Fortitude.
Yeah. Operation Fortitude, yes. Go back and listen to
Operation Fortitude.
But it was so much fun because it's just something that you never really take a step back and look at and be like, they actually, like, war wasn't just them fighting. War was a war of intelligence. It was a war of trickery.
It was an all-encompassing thing for some people for, like, 6 years. It shaped their daily existence for a period of 6 years. I don't, you know, of course, we can't understand that feeling because we've never been in a circumstance like that. But even those people that were, you know, alive in the U.S. during the time that World War II was going on, until they started doing like scrap rationing, things like that, even then, the impact that we felt here was so much, you know, so much less just because we weren't in danger of being attacked. We were just sending people over, mm-hmm. sending supplies over.
Germany couldn't hit us.
Yeah.
So we were pretty good. Unfortunately, Japan could hit us.
Well, we didn't think they could hit us, but they ended up hitting us. So today we are talking about the SOE, the Special Operations Executive, also known, this has to be the coolest fucking name. I know Churchill's Secret Army is a cool
pretty
name.
Pretty sweet.
But the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, which coincides, and also why we're doing this episode as well, there's an upcoming Guy Ritchie movie. The same name, the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. Looks fucking amazing.
Guy Ritchie, great actor. I'm kidding. I know he's a director. No,
you guys couldn't tell, but my head snapped so fucking fast over to Adam after he said that.
No, it's, again, this is something that when you're like, they're making this movie about these people, it is like, who are they? And you're like, it's a true story. And we started talking about it. You're like, we got to do an episode on these guys. There's no way that these guys don't deserve an episode. There's no way these guys don't deserve like five episodes for what they did.
And when guys I say guys and gals.
Yeah. Not just guys. There were a very large amount of females that went over and were in this spy agency. I truly didn't know when you first explained it to me that Special Operations Executive was more than one person. I thought he was the executive of special operations.
Oh, like, oh, no, Postmaster General is an actual...
It's a guy.
Yeah, it is a guy.
I guess executive must be, like, covert something.
Well, technically, there was, within the Special Operations Executive, a guy that kind of served as the executive of special operations.
Yes.
Well, a couple different guys. But, yeah, let's not wait around anymore. Yeah. Let's just get to it. Before we get into the episode, always remember, guys, rate, review, subscribe, 5 stars, please. It makes our waiters hard.
And you can do it all undercover.
You can do it all undercover. Keep sending us your feedback. We love hearing from you guys. And without further ado, we're getting into Churchill's Secret Army, the SOE, and the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. Okay, so the setting is World War II, kind of even pre-World War II, or at least pre-World War II as far as, like, involvement of the United States or anything.
It's a time where it was kind of like England is watching Germany, and they're like, don't you fucking do it. Don't you fucking you did it. Oh, now we have to figure some shit out.
While still saying, don't do it again. Don't do it. So... I'm not saying they saw the writing on the wall quickly, but, and I'm not sure what the extents, you know, how extensive spycraft and undercover black, you know, black ops and everything were during World War. I assume there was some type of commando units during World War One. We'll probably cover that at some point. But yeah, as soon as that started kind of popping off in Europe, the Brits decided to start this. There were already some intelligence gathering agencies at that time, and the SOE ends up being formed kind of as this amalgamation or merging of these three other agencies. And I think the three of them were, it was like Department EH, which stood for Electra House. It was just to the point where they were named after where their operations were based out of. So then they had...
EH was a propaganda wing.
Okay, that's why they each had kind of different stuff. You had the SIS, which basically is MI6, but they had a department called Section D, and it was D for demolition, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was like, you have your propaganda, now you have your sabotage, and then you get, I keep losing my place. Oh, GS. So they were all kind of merged together because they were all doing different things while all trying to kind of accomplish the same goal. And basically what the SOE specialized in was, and their mission was espionage, sabotage, and reconnaissance.
Well, and between the three of them, you really have everything covered. So like you said, EH was a propaganda wing. Section D investigated sabotage and propaganda and just using other ways to weaken an enemy. And then GS researched guerrilla warfare. So you're kind of starting to put together...
D like was demolitions. That's why it was Section D.
Demolitions as far as figuring out how to sabotage an enemy. And
you said propaganda too.
Well, I'm sure they were all kind of propagandized. Yeah, that's true. But with the way that you had these three wings come together, you almost had like your own little special operations unit where you could do like from soup to nuts. You could send in agents, you could get all the information, you can disrupt the enemy, and then if you have specialty operations, you're already researching guerrilla warfare to be able to send small amounts of commandos in to perform very specific tasks.
Well, and they said prior to kind of bringing these all under one umbrella, and why the formation of the SOE was not officially formed until July 2nd of 1940, and if you kind of know your World War II history, you're like, well, shit in Europe was going off as soon as the Nazis started rising to power. So that was back in like 38, 39, all that. You had these three separate departments that were independent of each other. You had two of them that didn't even communicate.
Yeah.
And were almost kind of going on top of each other and doing like the same type of work. So just doubling it up. You then had two of them were actually sharing information and kind of working together on different aspects. So they weren't just wasting their time. So finally, Churchill gets into power and he looks at that. He's like, we're fucking around. There's too many fingers in these pies. We're just going to merge it all into one and everyone's going to just form this as one special ops group.
Yeah, we're working way too hard to just achieve what we could achieve much faster if all three of you just did the same thing. If you work together as one unit and just shared shit, everything's going to come a lot faster.
You have your specialties in everything. And maybe this person that works in sabotage... And this person that works in, like, you get the sabotage guys, the demolition guys, and the guerrilla warfare guys all in one. And you're just like, oh, this is what we can also do in addition to the guerrilla warfare.
They were the war super friends.
So he taps this guy named Hugh Dalton, who was the Minister of Economic Warfare, which they have these titles that make it sound like they probably don't do a lot. It's just like, so it's the economy of the war. And you really don't think about that. But when you think about like the Nazi equivalent, like the Minister of Armaments and all that kind of stuff, you're like, oh, these guys were in charge of a lot of shit.
Minister sounds so much more official, too. Like there's a lot of cachet in that name, like Minister of Defenses. It's like, what do you do?
That is true. So he taps this guy to essentially kind of lead up this special department. And they were also known as the Baker Street Irregulars as well, because their home office was on Baker Street in London. Again, not super clever naming. They had some other better names, but just the fact that that was one of them. They employed, I think kind of at the peak or throughout the course of the existence of this department, 13,000 agents, 3,200 of them were women.
It's a big number, especially thinking that women weren't allowed overseas in a war capacity at that point.
That's close to 20-25%, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's between 20 and 25%.
There weren't women soldiers, were there, at that point?
No, part of the Geneva Convention apparently was that women could not, like, use arms.
Oh, that's right.
And then the reason they were able to circumvent this for this department is the... Apparently, they went and they were like, well, if we're going to have a special operations, we need to encompass everything. One of the things they found out was when France was occupied and all of the men were essentially either working their regular jobs, but also you had all of this infrastructure like we talked about in the Tot or Tote episode. That was a lot of like French workers that were building this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, German supervisors, some German people were doing that. You had women that were taking over roles that men had, kind of like here, like when guys went off to fight and women kind of stepped into other roles as far as like manufacturing, things like that.
Rosie the Riveter.
There you go. But that means that women were more likely to be out and about and be seen in different places a lot more so than it was in like normal society. So thinking as far as the espionage aspect of it and everything, and you want to be able to spy on everybody. Not just like have guys being around guys and trying to overhear something, but being able to get women in there, even when we're going to talk about it later, the art of using the art of seduction or just hiring ladies of the night. But so whoever was, I think it was Hugh Dalton or whoever's working under him is like, we need to be able to use women for this. And they're like, well, if we send them in there, we're sending, you know, most of our spies in at some degree armed or even just a pistol, or we're at least getting them in position where they can, you know, to defend themselves if, you know, in case shit goes down. He's like, well, women, part of the Geneva Convention is women can't fire. And he's like, you know, we have women that are manning the anti-aircraft guns for like the home defense and everything. And Churchill was just like, that's a good point. Go ahead and go with it. If we're already doing it, we're not going to pull those women off of doing that shit. We might as well just go full kilter into it.
The downside to this point in the Geneva Convention is also, you must be wearing a uniform to be participating in wartime activities.
Not participating, to be treated.
Oh, is that what it was?
Under the terms of the Geneva Convention as an enemy combatant treatment, which the Nazis didn't fucking even care in regards to that.
No, but if you're a dog shit spy and you get caught,
you don't have protection.
Yeah.
You can just be killed.
You're not wearing a uniform. You can be shot immediately. And I'm sure the women were
tortured. You're not protected from that shit either. I mean, just from a human rights perspective, you should be. But as part of the Geneva Convention, apparently you weren't protected.
Yeah, it seems so sketchy. But one of the things that I did hear was their thinking was, and I don't know how far off this was. I don't, maybe borderline misogynistic, but they said that men worked better in groups while women worked better alone, which I can see some of that stuff. I mean, it seems like I don't want to go down that road. Never mind there. But as far as like women go, they tend to be very efficient by themselves. Whereas men, we sort of need like a group to think.
That was some fancy backpedaling and then you pivoted juke step. No, yeah. I agree with that in the sense that, and up to this point, that was the just common thinking because there had been no examples of, you know, either women in combat or women working together. But at the same time, you do need all kinds of boots on the ground in order to make this as successful as it needs to be.
Not to mention women befriending wives of military leaders out in the open in these different countries that are occupied by Germans or Italians.
It's something as simple as like, shit, like you get a job. I didn't get too far into what their jobs would be, which I wish I kind of would have looked into it more because even as like sexist as this sounds, imagine if you got a job and you were trained as like a hairdresser at a place that was near where essentially like the Nazis that were essentially over in command of France and in Paris and everything like that, where all of their, you know, you were in that part of town where all their wives came and were just talking. That would be, I would not be surprised if there were roles like that in which they were like, no, we worked at actually like they had us working at a dry cleaners because the wives and the men would come in to have their uniforms pressed and everything. And you would overhear information. You could count troop movements running, moving by. It makes a ton of sense. And you can't have a man in that role.
No,
because it's a non-traditional role.
Yeah, it would be sniffed out immediately if it was a man. Plus, I do think that there's a lot of just along that line of thinking. It would be pretty smart to have them in sort of menial roles in different little townships, because you were able to see, like, if you had an influx of troops mm-hmm. in that area, you could radio out, and we'll talk about wireless transmissions and all that shit, but it's just having eyes on the ground to be able to see what's going on in areas.
Towns that were near train depots, roads that were, like, heavily traveled, where they would have to, like, when they were doing surveillance flights, reconnaissance, where they were like, well, if they're going to have to reinforce this area, and this is going to come in big during the D-Day, when we start talking about their yeah. role during D-Day, you were able to be like, okay, I just saw on your radio, be like, I just saw three companies of, or three armored divisions, like, move in through this crossroads heading this direction. Yeah. And they would know about troop movements that way. So there were people all over in just kind of all positions.
Did you hear how Hugh Dalton's tenure ended?
Well, I did. Yes, I did hear how that ended. One of the coolest Winston Churchill quotes that I don't know how we missed this during the Churchill episode, but after this thing got formed and the SOE was official, Churchill told Dalton, he's like, now go and set Europe ablaze.
Well, it was a secret army, so we didn't know about it during that episode.
That is true. So yeah, Hugh runs into some issues. Now, the thing about Hugh is, I'm not sure if it was him or some guys that he had brought in, but they kind of modeled how they were going to work with, as far as like the commando operations. They were inspired by the IRA. During the War for Irish Independence or something like that?
Yeah, I'm sure they saw a lot of guerrilla tactics used against them.
And they also took notes from, like, the, was it the Sandinistas, the ones that were on the other side. You had the Franco, the Republican, or whoever it was in Spain.
Yeah, not the Franco-Prussian War, but the War for Spanish Independence, wasn't it?
The Spanish Civil War, I thought. I can't remember which, but you saw the rebels and they took notes from how, like, the rebels were fighting and everything. So they were going to use these tactics and kind of merge them into their own. Yeah. Why did Dalton get ousted?
Dalton ended up getting ousted because even though war was at the forefront of everybody's mind and trying to protect the country and figure out how the world wars were going on, Dalton used the SOE to tap the phones of the labor ministers in England.
And I'm guessing he was not part of the Labor Party?
No, he was trying to get political information by using this special executive operations overseas in his own country.
His argument was like, I did not do this on company time. I did this all on my own, just using the resources, again, not on company time.
We're going to send this army out and not test them?
I was looking for spies in the ministry. Yeah, so he's out in 1942, and a guy named Sir Charles Hambro, he's in. And Hambro, out in 43, during the tenure of this, and then this guy named Colin Gubbins, who had been in from the start just in a lower rank, mm-hmm. he was finally in as the head of this department. As far as this, you know, why you might not know about this is that if you ever think of British intelligence due to James Bond, everyone automatically thinks of MI6. There's also an MI5, an MI5, MI4, and they're all specializing in different things. You might hear the SAS because that's like the actual now special operations for the Brits. If you've ever played a Call of Duty game, you're extremely familiar with the SAS.
Yeah.
This only went from 1940 to 1946, the end of 1946. I say that because the stuff that we're going to cover during this, the fact that all of this was done and they somehow weren't still around and were ended. I mean, I know it was peacetime and everything after that. It's kind of crazy. And it got merged in. Of course, it wasn't just like everyone was just on their ass. It was just like, we're just merging you in with like MI6 or the SIS.
I would say that it's probably better for England that they were shut down, because what did we do with the OSS?
Oh, yeah.
We turned it into the CIA, and we know about a lot of black ops that the CIA has.
That is a very good point.
So maybe for England, they avoided some headaches later on down the line, not continuing this SOE.
So essentially, kind of, you know, again, the main objective is being sabotage, subverting the Axis powers. Of course, their job in more of a clandestine role isn't to win the war. It's essentially information gathering to allow the military itself the best chance of winning the war, and where they could to disrupt the movement and effectiveness of the Axis. Now, they had a couple different departments within the Special Operations Executive. One of them, Section D, was code breaking and explosives. They said there was a time when they were both working code breaking and explosives in the same building. And then they were like, we probably shouldn't have all our code analysis working in the same fucking buildings as the guys that are building fucking explosives. So yeah. They eventually separated them, kept them under Section D, just in separate buildings. Station XV, I don't know if it was the Roman numeral, that was camouflage and clothing. They hired people, and we talked about this, I think, during Fortitude, where they actually hired set designers to be able to do stuff. They would hire actors in order to train the agents how to essentially assume a role.
This was a life and death thing. Mm-hmm. So you have to, this Section 40 place that you're talking about has to be enough of like a training and teaching to be able to keep these people's lives intact. Like, it's so important to be able to know the role and act the part, because your literal life depends on it. And I'm sure that's what the people are thinking. But at the same time, if you're losing these intelligence agents all across the country, it's going to be negative for your military operations, too.
The scope of what they were doing, though, was so massive, in the sense of, like, okay, so it was all volunteers. So this wasn't something people were assigned to. All walks of life, because you had at this point a huge influx of people coming in to essentially Britain for safe haven that were coming out of these conquered territories. So, like, there were a bunch of French refugees that were coming in, people fleeing France, a bunch of Polish people that were fleeing there. They probably had people from any and every country that got taken over.
Oh, yeah.
What that allowed them to do was to have a pool of native people from those countries. Or people, a lot of them having dual citizenship and everything, if they were had family in both of them, to essentially, in some cases, bypass that language barrier and to have someone know all the customs, and then just had to train them up essentially on, like, the spy craft, the radio operations. So not only were they sending people in to just, like, spy, gather troop movements, things like that, you also have the people that were getting sent in to essentially equip and train the resistance fighters in these countries.
Well, the other important thing about getting native speakers, like you were talking about with language, is you can teach languages to anybody. Like, that's not the issue. The issue is, however you learn that language, you're still going to have the accent of the language of origin that you spoke mm-hmm. in the beginning. So if you can get these refugees coming from these countries that don't have that accent, it's just that much deeper of a layer of security. Because if you have a German, it's like, why do you speak French with an English accent? Then you have to explain that. But if you don't sound like you have the original accent while you're speaking French, they're just going to assume that you've been there the whole time.
Not only that, but one of the things, just like in the U.S., there's so many different accents of just
dialects,
of English itself, that the same is true in areas in France where people speak different dialects of French and have different flourishes on certain words and certain pronunciation of certain letters and words that are different. So even if you were trained in French, which, man, some of the training that they were doing here, it's insane, because if you don't know the language and you're having to learn it, fuck, that's already the biggest disadvantage you probably have in that entire thing. But if you do know the language and it's from a different region than you're going to be in, you come in and they're like, well, you speak perfectly fluent French, but if it's a little bit off or something, then you can be like, well, I'm not from this area. Or you get to send everyone to specific areas where they blend in almost seamlessly. Whereas if you're teaching someone, you know, a non-native speaker, that person is only going to learn, even if they learn it the best, they're only going to learn the dialect of a very specific area that they can be in.
Well, and a Welsh person speaking French, you're definitely going to know that they're not
a native I don't think speaker. those were commandos.
Okay.
So right. It was also, as part of this, the sabotage aspect of it, you also had commando operations that the SOE do. So they were doing the espionage aspect. And again, going back to that guerrilla warfare and sabotage, that was, I think, more so where you were going to get your full British soldier types. Okay. Is where you're going to get those guys.
Well, and not only was the language so important, but like you said, it was the customs too. It was down to the little millimeters of understanding of like, this person is from here. There was a woman that I had read about that she, when she landed, and we'll talk about the whole landing and stuff, cause that's all fascinating. But when she got to this village or town or wherever she was in, all the women had gold hoop earrings in. And so she actually had to find a pair of gold hoop earrings or make a pair of gold hoop earrings so she would blend into the society. Yeah. As far as clothing and things like that go, any of the refugees that were coming from these countries, they were asking for their clothing so they could use them to send the spies over in like native clothing or so they could make replicas of them. Their luggage that they were carrying, they just beat the shit out of. Cause if you're rolling into a country with new money and new luggage,
they probably took the luggage of those people too.
Yeah. It's all going to look funny. So it goes down to another story. I think I was telling you about it. The, spy that got caught because he was in France and he didn't smoke his cigarette like a Frenchman. He didn't smoke it all the way down to the filter.
He threw away like half a cigarette and they're like, no.
Yeah, the Germans are like, you're not French, man. French people finish all their cigs.
I told you that reminds me exactly of that scene in Inglourious Bastards where they send in the British guy and his accent again is off, but he explains he's from a different area, in, you know, Germany or Bavaria or whatever. And he goes to order 3 glasses of whiskey and he holds up his three, you know, the index, the middle finger and the ring finger. Mm-hmm. And I guess in German, the way they count it is the thumb, the index finger and the middle finger or something like that.
The most ridiculous way to do three. But then
you also have three where you hold the thumb.
That one makes sense. Finger.
Yeah. But that's exactly what it reminds me of. I saw when they, during the documentary, when they were showing some actual footage, they would take, if they had to make replicas, of course they couldn't get zippers from France or whoever was making zippers there. So they were making zippers and using like a dentist tool to grind off any of the wording or anything like that, that would essentially just make them generic.
YKK zippers weren't a thing back then on everything. Mm-hmm. They had to fashion everything just homemade.
I was going to say, in addition to that, you had the other station was Station XIV. I should have really written down the Roman numerals for this, but they specialized in
14.
14?
Yep.
Forged documents. So to get into these countries, I mean, if you've ever seen a World War II movie series, you'll see the guys walking around for papers, and you'd have to show your identification. Well, you not only have to have identification that's passable, that looks like it's weathered, all that stuff. You have to have it from a specific region that's going to have then a backstory, possible, you know, some type of confirmation that you're from that area. They had to essentially build these people lives and have all of the documents that they would ever need completely on the up and up and passable to the exact replicas of wherever they were going to be going, France, Poland. Every country that was occupied had a department of SOE, or at least a branch of the SOE in it. Yep. That was operating as like a cell. The only ones that didn't have them, as it was agreed upon, were the United States and then also Russia. So you didn't have them. And then also neutral countries, I believe. Like
neutral countries they could escape to, but they couldn't work within.
Correct. They couldn't operate like a cell out of that or like an office out of that.
Yeah, no networks there. I wonder why that is. You think America and Russia were like, nah, keep your secret people over there. We don't need them in our countries because like we don't want you guys hearing what we're talking about.
Correct. Yes, that's exactly it.
It was.
Why would you need to have people here? Your people should be fighting the enemy.
Well,
that would have been the excuse. But of course, it's for the fact that, yeah, you could gather information because it wasn't long into the war that we knew who the next war was going to be against.
Which makes me think that we had OSS agents in Russia. And
I'm sure England we did. Sure. I'm just saying the agreement of the SOE was that they wouldn't operate in friendly countries.
Yeah.
Even had offices and departments over in the Pacific. In like, was it Malaysia and... Australia.
Australia was another big spot for them where they'd stopped. But everybody kind of had the issue with them being in Malaysia and over in Asia was you can't train for the kind of terrain and weather climates in England that you're going to be facing in Asia. It's not possible.
Not only that, buddy, you're not going undercover in those countries and blending with the local populace. You stand out like a sore fucking thumb.
Yeah, you're and to have to make connections, just like you said. What were they? The French Resistance in France. Mm-hmm. There was a Norwegian sect that was a resistance. But over in Asia, with Japan fighting China, you had to go make inroads with the Chinese to try to team up with them.
You were a facilitator at that point. Uh-huh. You were running the station, and then these guys were working for you instead of being an actual agent yourself. Well, on the flip side of that, more of the actual like military or like assault portion of it. A large part of their mission centered around espionage and then also terror attack. So training centered around what was deemed to be ungentlemanly acts, hence the name. There was a lot of pushback from the more stuffy of the British command that for some reason had it that they had to fight the entire war using, what would you consider it, morally...
Gentlemen's rules.
Well, that might have worked when everyone was wearing like all the medals on their jackets and carrying sabers around. But when you're in a war, essentially for the survival of your country, and you're fighting against an enemy that has basically just steamrolled everybody else, and you're this last little bastion of, you know, refuge, everything's on the fucking table at that point. And so these ungentlemanly acts, they were trained in lockpicking, demolition, sabotage, cutting railways. You had some situations of assassination. There was a mission that we'll talk about here in just a little bit with the Czechoslovakian guys or the Polish guys.
The Norwegians?
Reinhardt is the one of the assassination of Reinhardt.
Oh, I don't remember which one it was.
We'll get to it in a sec. You also had hand-to-hand combat, learning how to shake a tail. Escape was a huge one. They taught these guys, and they had departments within this, the SOE, that were so solely focused on how to both facilitate the escape from these, you know, prisoner of war camps, and also facilitate not only the escape from the camp itself, but then to actually get them into areas in which they, you know, to get them to Spain, get them to Sweden somewhere, get them into friendly, you know, friendly hands in the French resistance, where they could then get them back to Britain and be debriefed and provide them any and all information.
Just like we talked about the rat lines for the Nazis that escaped to South America, these were escape lines where if you needed to get somebody out of the country, or even if you had a large group of people that were French that wanted to get out of France, you built these escape lines, and it was basically like the Underground Railroad of Europe, where you could send them to different houses, cabins along the way. You're providing them fake documents. You're providing them money, rations, anything that you need to get them out of the country and get them free and safe.
Bomber pilots.
Yeah.
Any bomber pilots, because you're not flying bomber missions over fucking Britain. You're flying over occupied France, and in a lot of situations later, you're flying over Germany. So if you're in occupied France and your bomber gets shot down, you're looking for essentially a friendly face or the resistance to try to help you out before the fucking Germans find you.
Well, and even a brilliant part of that, if you're trying to get civilians out and you're sending them back to England, that just grows your pool of people who are going to want to go back and fight the resistance that are native people to those areas.
Not only that, but you're also helping yourself from a strategic perspective, because now you have, because all those people coming in as refugees, they were all debriefed. I mean, to varying degrees and everything, but basically people that lived in areas in which they didn't have a clear-cut way of how it looked, where, you know, mountains were, where hills were, strategic positions, all of those people coming in from France or those areas that were like, yeah, I'm from that town. They're like, tell us everything you know. How long does it take you to get from this point to this point? What are the roads like? During this time of year, are there routes that you can't take that you can take? That was a huge thing in Normandy, was anybody that had knowledge of the Normandy area was like, just give us any and every bit. Like, tell us about the Johnson's farm or whoever, the LaJacques farm that was down the way from you. Like, how close were you to the beach?
Well, and I think we even talked about it, and we'll talk about it again later on in this episode with one of the agents, but England was asking for any tourists that had ever taken pictures of the beaches in France sent in so they could be used as evidence to, or not evidence, but used tactically to figure out like where the best places would be to land.
So if you went the route where you were more on the commando side, you would do your training in Scotland. Everybody got parachute training.
I will say, before you explain this, during a documentary when I started seeing this, my brain immediately went to what were Scotland and Ireland doing during World War II? Because you don't ever hear about them being occupied or going in and out. I didn't realize that they both just immediately declared neutrality.
Did they really?
Yeah.
I did not know that, actually.
I'd never thought about what Scotland, England were doing, or Scotland and Ireland were doing, because they are kind of in the mix over there in areas. Yeah. I mean, they're islands, but they can still be taken over.
Scotland is part of the United Kingdom.
Well, in Ireland, I believe, had suffered a few bombing raids from the Germans, but beyond that, there wasn't a whole lot of their involvement.
Well, they did facilitate the commando training,
yeah, which,
and other training. I believe they also had airfields up in Scotland. So, and of course, you're going to try to get them as far away from Germany for flyover reconnaissance flights, so you have stuff up there.
Where were they being trained in Scotland?
Do you know?
Oh, yeah.
Where?
They were being trained on manners. So not like military facilities. Anybody that had like
big castles
plots
and shit?
Of, yeah, castles and plots of land to where they could go out and do these trainings in these big areas and fields. But like in the houses, they were hiring people. And like you talked about, they're coming from all walks of life. So people with like criminal backgrounds and like robbery or anything like that were teaching lessons in lockpicking. You had people that were trained in hand-to-hand combat that were probably ruffians, had been in multiple fights and different things like that that had gotten them arrested.
The term ruffian.
Ruffians, yeah.
They're scallywags.
But you had, I guess you would call them like people of ill repute that were training all these soldiers, but they couldn't do it out in the open.
It's like learning how to fight dirty.
Yeah, and they were training.
Before, it was the difference between the old boxing stance, the OBC, where it's one, the fisticuff stance, between now you're going to start throwing some fucking leg kicks. Like, we got to start leg kicking these motherfuckers.
But they had to do it in kind of inconspicuous areas. So like, just like the Baker Street building, that was just a street that was in England that really had no significance.
Like an apartment complex that had been like repurposed.
So if you're hiding these people in manors, you have all this room to do like parachuting and jumps and shit like that. You're learning how to throw Molotov cocktails, grenades on the outside.
I'm trying to remember if it was in Scotland or England, but I remember when they were planning a specific mission, they would actually build from surveillance. They would, you know, the way that they would train is they would build replicas of these areas and have them go through the motions so they would be able to know these places inside and out. There's a scene off Band of Brothers where they're getting ready to jump into Normandy and they're going over like a week before or like a few weeks before. They give them the information regarding like where they're going to be jumping into, and they give them like a pretty good period of time to study all of these sand tables, all of the topography of the country. So essentially any soldier can serve as eyes and ears for what they're seeing. And as far as like training and stuff, you had to have room enough to spread out and do that kind of training without attracting attention from potentially any type of like German spies or anything like that. The parachute training, I think, took place in Manchester, but everybody, the men and the women, did parachute training because that's how you had to get into these areas.
A lot of the time, and 95% of the time, it was going to be a paramilitary drop at night, which, again, this is, you and I have talked about it, this is the rivers traveling north to me, is the way that they would do it, and we talked about it during the World War II episode, but when you're jumping out of these planes with a parachute, you don't have your own ripcord.
It's static line.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
You just have a line that's attached to the side of the airplane, and as you jump out, when you get to the end of that line, it rips your chute for you.
Yes.
This to me seems like there's so many flaws that could happen.
No, way more the other way.
You think it was more efficient that way?
They're having to drop them lower.
Yeah.
To you know, stay below mountain range and stuff like that. But to have someone jump and literally only have to worry about jumping and holding on, that it's going to do all the work for you. It's going to deploy your chute as soon as possible, leaving the plane. If something happens and that gust of wind hits you and you get disoriented and you're, let's say you just fucking freeze with fear and you're not pulling your chute, the fact that that static line is there is meant to essentially make it to where it's a no-brainer. You don't have to worry about anything. All you got to do is worry about jumping out of the plane and then you're going to land.
My concern with the static line is it gets tangled and it launches too soon and that shoots too close to the airplane.
No, there was a very specific... You've not watched Band of Brothers yet, have you?
No.
Okay.
It's too long.
No, it's not. Watch it in increments. You are missing out. What they would do is they had a line that went right down the middle of the plane. Everyone would clip onto that line, but everyone was standing holding the clip in their hand. Checked each other's equipment. Yeah. Yes. And the clip just ran down the line. And as soon as they got to the guy standing by the door, they passed the clip. He would grab the clip. The other guy that left, the line would be around the side of the plane flapping there. It wouldn't interfere with you at all. His line is already gone. That guy is holding your line with it attached to the wire. There's no tangling because you're going one at a time. It's go, go, go.
Okay. I'm going to trust you on this one. It just seems like there's so many errors. But yeah, I do see the human element of it, of like freezing in fear and not pulling your chute.
But think of it in this perspective. These people are not receiving comprehensive combat and jump training. They're just learning how to essentially jump out of the plane and survive the fall. At that point, once they land, they're having to bury their chutes, hope that they got dropped in the place that they were supposed to get dropped in, hope that the first people that find them, because it's at night, are going to be friendly French resistance or someone friendly in France. Because guess what? If you just get found walking around at night by a fucking German squad and it's you just come from fucking Britain an hour ago or less than that, it doesn't bode well for the success of your mission.
No, but this is probably one of my favorite parts about this whole thing was the deployments in, because what would happen would be they would already have boots on the ground, whether it was French resistance or whether it was just another part of the group that was in
there. Not initially. There were some, remember, they did the blind drops.
Yeah.
Where they were the first wave of, fuck me, the balls on those people.
Well, you knew what you were getting into. They told you that your survival rate wasn't going to be high.
I don't think you can't know what you're getting into. You can have an idea. And one of the guys is like, we were just full of ideals. He's like, that's why we did it. A lot of them were like, we didn't know what to expect. You're jumping in. You don't know anyone there. You've been training in this language that now you have to be like, I hope I fucking paid close enough attention in all of this training that I know it well enough that when fear kicks in and everything, I'm not showing it and I don't slip up because my life completely depends on me. And not only that you hope you paid attention, I hope they taught me the correct shit, because yeah. If any of it was wrong or like the trends were off or I'm speaking in a slang that doesn't exist and they thought that it did because they heard someone speaking it, like, I'm fucked.
One of the debriefings that I heard that they would give would be you had a chance to decline your position in a group up until you loaded onto the plane.
You had your chance to decline the mission.
Yeah, the mission. Not yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, because
you could still say, if you're standing there in a parachute waiting to load up, you can still say uncle. But as soon as you get on that airplane, you know what's about to happen.
So you would have situations where, you know, they had to end up, a big problem was the SOE getting access to aircraft from the RAF because they were essentially fighting the Battle of Britain and bombing everything.
No spares.
Yeah, they ended up getting a couple planes from them so they would be able to do these nighttime drops, which imagine if you're the pilot of that plane and you're like, my job is to just fly in as quiet as fuck at night and just try to drop this person.
Irregularly close to the ground.
Irregularly close to the ground and then just try to fly back in. This person's going into like hostile territory, like just the thought process. I wonder if, because I heard they kept the pilots and the people sequestered even during the flight to where they wouldn't communicate or anything like that. So if the plane went down and they were torturing for, they could not describe that person or anything like that. So they had larger, you know, bombers that they had kind of retrofitted to drop these guys. They also had these planes called Lysanders.
Mm-hmm.
And the Lysander was a single engine, like wing on the top of it, plane that could carry, I think, three people, the pilot and two other people, and then some cargo. These little one engine planes would fly across the channel. They could land, I think, in 150 yards, right? Did you hear how they did it?
How they marked the territories?
With the flashlights.
They were gonna land, yeah.
And they would do it because the process had to be so fast. They would essentially have the pilot land with the wind,
mm-hmm.
and they would go out on flashlights when they had this 150-yard, you know, it could land almost anywhere on these farm fields. They would go and put flashlights up on these posts, and the first flashlight would designate the area they were supposed to come into.
And it was red.
And it was red. The second one would designate a point that's where the end of it was or something like that. And the third one was where they were supposed to turn around facing. So then they were taking off into the wind and can get up the ground fast.
It was just they fashioned a 3 flashlight runway.
Yes. And it was like a fucking pit stop.
Uh-huh.
So they would be flying in these people. They would get out, get whatever luggage or whatever, you know, cargo they had and everything. And then a lot of these times during these drops, they would have stuff to send back, or perhaps a person going back or things like that. They said that the time from landing to turnaround, they would do this in like around 3 minutes, because as they were bringing the plane around to go upwind, they were already getting out of the plane, unloading the people that were there, loading the people back in, and this thing was back up in the air. Well, and it was unarmed. It was just like a small little like cargo, like biplane type thing. So it had no protection against fighters.
And the way that this happened, it's so interesting. I mean, you're talking about the landings. The people that are jumping out at night, it's kind of the same way as far as getting down. First thing they would do, exactly like you said, they would get down, they would cut their parachute lines or whatever. First job, bury the parachute. So that way nobody can tell as far as coming in to check the area, you know, is there a big parachute laying on the ground, anything like that. They hid that.
It's going to be a red flag for the surrounding area.
Somebody showed up if there's just an empty parachute.
Is this a recreational parachute? Someone's just skydiving?
The second thing that they did was these people from the resistance groups, or if it's an SOE member or something, that flagged down where the landing was going to be. They would collect any of the other equipment that was dropped along with the people, and they would either bury that too, if they needed to come back to it days later to get to it. Like if they couldn't all take it all then,
or cart or something like that. Yeah.
But they would ride for miles on bicycles in the middle of the night to get out to these fields that they were designating would be these drop zones. So once you got all that stuff done, these cells that they would work in, they were called networks. There was an agent, then there was a courier, and then there was somebody called a wireless operator. I didn't realize this back then, but they were wireless radios that they had back in the 40s. Didn't know that wireless was a thing back then. Yeah. I thought everything had to be plugged in.
On lines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But these cells were so important because these groups that were together, you had a courier that would be somebody that would be running between agents, handing off information, news, secret.
Getting information stuff back to where they could transmit it back, going to those plane drops and everything to load stuff back up.
You'd have a wireless transmitter that person would just be solely in charge of sending anything back to Britain through wireless transmission on their radios that they needed to. They were all very well-versed in Morse code. One of the things that they would get would be a cheat sheet that would be flown into the country on a semi-regular basis where their Morse code patterns would be changed in order to still keep away undercover. So you had two very important roles in the top agent that was running.
Of course, that was coded, though. That was encoded. Okay.
But they were sending like different Morse code
coding. You can say the word cipher.
Ciphers, yeah.
You told me you got tired of hearing that word.
Well, it immediately takes me to a serial killer
that we'll
definitely do an episode on.
I want to talk about the radios real quick, because this was something you don't think of. So getting communication out, your information is no good once you're there unless you can get the information back that you're trying to acquire. So along with these couriers, that would be essentially the runners between this. And this is where a lot of the women actually were, is because, kind of like I mentioned before, because a lot more women were out in the workforce and being able to be out and about, it made sense that they could kind of move unnoticed. Instead of if a guy was out there moving around, they're going to be like, why, what's your job? Like, if you're not working on like the fucking sub pens or any of that kind of stuff, like, what do you do? And so, you know, a lot of the women were the couriers. You would have essentially kind of what you would consider like the cell chief, the guy that was in charge that might control a couple other different agents and everything. But the radios that they had, so originally these radios would have to be like plugged into power. They got, and what they found out about this is essentially apparently directional finding for radio signals was even a thing at this point. You would have the Gestapo searching through France, because they wouldn't be able to pick up radio signals. That's why it had to be encoded, is because you don't know what they're saying, but you know someone is out there transmitting. They would be able to essentially directional find these transmissions down to a certain area, probably miles and miles and miles and miles. What they would then do is they would turn off the power to certain sections of that area, and they would wait to see if the radio signal cut out. And then as soon as that cut out, they knew it was in that area. They would maybe do something similar to get it to a small area. And then when they started suspecting things, they would wait until, because when it first started, there were specific times that they were meant to transmit. That
30 minutes changed. They were on for.
Yeah. And then they would go up to a house or a series of houses, turn off the power. And if any of those houses lost the radio signal stopped, they knew it was one of those houses. And then they, you know, a ton of them got caught and sent to prisoner of war camps, if not killed outright.
I hate how brilliant that strategy is, though. That's very smart on the Germans' part to be able to shut down those sections.
I couldn't have fathomed that.
Saw how they worked around it, finally.
Well, they ended up getting down to these things that were called the AMK-3 radio. It was 9 pounds. It could run with batteries. Its batteries, it was 9 pounds. It could fit into, it's a briefcase, but I love it when they call it, it could fit into an attaché case. Now, the range on these isn't, you know, unless you're close to the coast and everything, the range on these wasn't like super extensive because, again, this is a radio during World War II running off batteries. There was a larger radio that they had. I think it was like 18 pounds, probably required a little bit more. And that one had a range of, I think, 500 miles. So you would probably have, in some circumstances, you would have these cells that were communicating with then ones that had more powerful radios or ones that were relaying messages closer to the coast to where they could get them over to Britain, I would imagine.
Before they had the battery-powered radios, one way that they would subvert, like, them being able to be found was they would take vehicles and they would drive cars out into the country, and then they would hook the radios up to the car battery.
Ooh.
So that way they couldn't be found in the range of, like, a town or a city because they have their own solar or singular power source.
And then it wouldn't also draw attention to that to make them think that there was, you know, a cell operating in that city or that area.
These people, these agents were brilliant in the way that they just did everything. And so much of it is like necessity is the mother of invention. Because I'm sure once they got over there, like you were talking about second guessing your training. If you're second guessing your training and then you get over there and that second guess is confirmed, you don't really have a way to protect yourself at that point. You're in the shit and you need to adapt to survive. So I'm sure they were coming up with all sorts of different ways. They were still keeping the same, like, basics of how to stay communicated. But then they were also sort of, like, morphing their plans as to how they were going to be.
A lot of it was their discretion.
Yeah, it was on the fly.
Yeah. And, you know, to gather the best information, you need to be around where there's a lot of troop movement or, you know, a strategic position. Well, those are also going to be the places that have more security, more fucking Gestapo trying to track you down, because the enemy knows that you do have spies in this country. Oh, yeah. And if you're going to have spies in this country, these are the areas that you're most likely to be spying on.
They said the courier. This shocked me. I guess it would be the mortality
average rate. Life expectancy.
Well,
once they were there,
the average life expectancy they said was 6 weeks. There was a 40% chance that they weren't going to come back, but
I heard 50-50.
Well, the mortality was the most dangerous job in the army or during the war was a pilot, obviously, and their rate was like 45% of them would be taken down at some point and potentially die. Second was couriers. It was at 42%. So you're the second most dangerous job in the war is these couriers behind enemy lines.
Well, we get to some of the all-stars for the SOE before we're going to talk about some of the more well-known missions that I wish we would just know all about it, because you only know we're getting just a snippet of what went down during this. And you know that if the stuff we do know about was like this fucking cool, then the hidden stuff that we never found out about has got to be way better.
I think there was a law put in place. I'm not sure. Maybe an English listener can send in and correct us. I think it was up until 1960, there was a moratorium on agents being able to talk about anything that they had done during World War II.
For fear of reprisal or because the information was still pertaining or something like that? Yeah,
still top secret as to how they did it. So there was a very large section of time where, like, you knew that these people were spies and had been over there, but they could never share their story or talk about it.
They didn't get, like, a memorial until either the 90s or the early 2000s. I
think it was early 2000s, yeah. It's crazy how unrecognized these guys went for so long. And not to say, like, once they got back, they were all heroes. There were movies made about them. There was a lot of talk of some of the shit that they did. But to me, this is why I love doing World War II stuff and getting into these niche topics, is these people didn't win the war, but they helped us win the war.
Yeah.
Like, they were a very big part of it. They weren't engaging in battle, but they were engaging in skirmishes.
Psychological or intellectual warfare.
Well, and even...
informational warfare.
Rousing up the French revolutionaries to...
being able to arm them.
Yeah.
To get them into positions where the SOE and, you know, the British could actually send them arms to actually arm them. They... one of the things that they invented, plastic explosives. The SOE is responsible for plastic explosives. One thing I didn't know about this... well, I actually think I did kind of know, but the whole thing with plastic explosive is... you can mold it and you can hit it and it doesn't get detonated by force.
It has to be an electric charge.
It has to be like a detonation that actually sets it off. Have you heard of these things? They're called time pencils. It was invented by a guy in the SOE.
The guns?
No.
Oh.
So I think you've probably seen them in movies before, but it's the thing with that they stick down into the plastic explosive and they pinch the top of it.
Oh, yeah.
What that is essentially there's a type of acid in the top of it in a glass vial. It then has to go through a wad of cotton and eat through that. Once it hits that cod of cotton, it releases something that sends the firing pin down to the bottom of the explosive to set off the charge. The guy that designed this made versions that could last anywhere from 10 minutes up to 24 hours. Not like saying like you pinch this and it's either 10 minutes or 24 hours that it's going to go off or any time in between. He had them to where if it was within an hour, one of his hour versions, it was accurate within, I think they said, about 3 or 4 minutes.
Well, that'll be important because they were essentially fuses and you need to be
time delay fuses, yeah. Which is what you need during sabotage commando operations where you need to be in there and you're not looking for a firefight. You're looking to go in there, accomplish the objective, and then get out before they even knew you were there and already have a head start.
Well, along with that, not even full-facing wars, but like you were talking about with arming French revolutionaries or anything like that, they're not going to take on the Germans, but if they can take a few pot shots at Germans that are traveling through that area and can divert their attention and take away some of their resources.
Harass them, slow them down. Force them to move. If they're dealing with a lot of resistance that they can't handle in one area, they have to then reposition troops and it weakens that area.
You're just causing chaos.
One thing, did you see any of the weapons that they had developed? The suppressed weapons?
That's what I was just trying to figure out. What was the magnetic mine that they created?
The limpet mine.
Limpet mines, that's what they were.
And they called it a limpet mine because apparently a limpet is a type of sea slug that attaches to boats and so it kind of looked like that. So they had these suppressed weapons. One was called the Delisle carbine, and it was the guy's last name was Delisle, and it was a 45 caliber rifle.
Carbine rifle.
Carbine rifle, no flash, and was inaudible at 50 yards. So once you were 50 yards away from it, you couldn't fucking hear it. They had this thing called the well rod, and it was basically a pistol, and it looked like, you know, when you see James Bond put the silencer on, it extends the gun like 8 inches.
Yeah.
Imagine the entire barrel is like just 16 inches of silencer right off the fucking chamber. And it basically had zero markings on it. They didn't put anything except a serial number and then a smattering of weird symbols. So they couldn't tell who fucking made it because the serial number could be in different languages and everything. And I think they said that that was accurate up to like 25 or 30 feet, but they already had like fucking silenced like pistols and rifles that they were sending over for use. And also during like the special commando operations,
they had single shot pencil guns that they had used as well. So you had that
James Bond shit, dude. They had plastic explosives that were made to look like rats that were stuffed inside fake rats. And what they would do is they would, and the fucking pencil thing is sticking out. I'm not even joking. Like the pencil fuse is sticking out the ass. They would be able to take them in and use them and then like just throw under stuff like boilers and stuff. If they were trying to take out factories just as something, because if they got caught, they could drop in. If someone just looked down at the ground, they're like, oh, it's just a fucking rat. And would be able to hide that kind of stuff.
Grenade's going to stick out. A rat's going to be a dime a dozen in a place like that.
One of the things they had for special operations, did you see for Commando Ops, the Sleeping Beauty canoes? Did you see those? So it looks like a cross between a canoe and a kayak. And basically you would be sitting kind of like up above it, like you would in a canoe or a kayak. And then it had a skirt that covered you all the way up to the neck, completely watertight. You then had a breather mask on,
mm-hmm.
and it was motorized and had ballast in it to where it could submerge under the water. They said it could go down to like 50 feet. And it had a range, I think 30 to 40 nautical miles. So they would drop these guys
off by submarine. Boats.
They said they would drop some of them by aircraft. It could be dropped by a bomber. So like it would drop it, and then the guy would drop parachute.
Okay.
It could land. He would then get out, get into it, and go.
That makes way more sense. I thought you were saying they dropped him in the thing.
I thought that too, and I was like, God damn! Like if you turned upside down, that would fucking hurt.
You're not coming back up.
But unfortunately, these things didn't get used that often, but they would do this thing that I saw where it was called porpoising, and they would be under the water, just under the surface going toward it. If they needed to gain their bearings, they would basically aim them up. And as soon as they saw, you know, when you're swimming underwater, you can see your reflection as you're swimming closer if you're upside down. As soon as the nose touched its reflection, they would aim it down to dive again, and it would just raise the top of their head out of the water. They would look around for a split second, see where they needed to go, and then they were back underwater in that direction.
Yeah, it's a brilliant strategy, and probably learned it from a porpoise.
I'm guessing, probably. Yeah, they had those around back then and for many years prior.
I love that you're laying this stuff out, because this just makes this Gustav Beeler story so much more perfect, because he uses so many of these things that you're talking about.
Before we get into Mr. Beeler, can we take a bathroom break?
Yeah.
Oh my God, Adam. What is that up in the sky? It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's socials. Oh my God. It's faster than Instagram.
That's historically high pod on Instagram.
More powerful than X?
It's historically high, historically HI on X.
Able to leap tall threads in a single bound.
Back to historically high pod on Threads.
And, I mean, I guess there's still Gmail, right?
We got that too. That is historicallyhighpodcast@gmail.com.
All right, guys, back to the show. All right, tell me about Gustav.
Gustav, or Guy, as he was known, he was one of the better known SOE agents that worked in France. He ran something called the Musician Network, and it was outside of a city or a town called St. Quentin. And just like Chris was talking about, anywhere where there were going to be massive troop movements, if they had taken over a power plant or anything like that around these cities, they would set up these SOE networks, and they would name them different things. There would be communications between them, but it would kind of be like cells of these agents that would be working around the cities. And Gustav ran this Musicians Network. He commanded 25 teams that were scattered all over northern France. So a pretty big reach.
It's got to be a lot of fucking pressure.
Well, and not to mention his teams were responsible for bombing German fuel storage tanks, rail lines, bridges, canal locks that were used for German transport. These canal locks, one night, middle of the night, all this stuff is secure. It's all being watched and guarded 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Anything that has strategic value for moving troops, moving supplies, anything like that, that was being, pretty much anything that was being used by the Germans had German security.
Yeah. So Gustav gets this idea one night. He's like, well, we keep seeing all of these German shipments coming through the river, coming through this lock system. If we can stop that flow of transportation down the river, they're going to have to figure out different ways to do it, and it's going to slow them way down. One night in the middle of the night, they jumped in one of those canoes that you were talking about, floated down the river. And as they were traveling under one of the lock systems, bridges, they slapped those lipit mines down at the bottom of them.
Mm-hmm.
As they continued floating down the river, you hear the explosion behind it. It closed down the lock system in the river for 6 weeks. That's how much damage they had done. So 6 weeks of them not being able to transport anything along the river, just absolutely shut down any of the German transport that was going through there. He was so successful in the shit that he did that once the Gestapo found out about him, they instituted a special manhunt for him and his team. So this guy was so well known by the Germans for all the shit that they had done that they put out a special bulletin like, hey, this is the guy that we have to take in. And they had actually figured that out because they had gotten a hold of one of the wireless radios, and they were running something called a counter radio campaign, where they were keeping up kind of like speaking to England and talking to the other networks and gaining more and more intel to be able to go through and round these people up.
Had they captured any agents when they caught that radio?
The agents had escaped, but they had left the radio behind. So they had left the radio behind. They had left their Morse code call signs and all that kind of stuff.
And again, they had Gestapo had agents too that could speak in British accents and everything. So they were running the same type of shit.
Yeah.
Nowhere near as successful when it actually took place in Britain.
It was just to get these information or to get this information and to figure out where these cells were and where these networks were that they could end up taking down, because these guys were causing a lot of issues for them. But his ending is kind of crazy. He ends up getting arrested in a cafe in St. Quentin. He was meeting with a woman named Yolanda Beekman, and oh, there it is.
Was she also
she was an agent, okay. Yeah. So she was a part of the network. They rushed in. They took him away. He was taken to a place called Flossenbürg concentration camp in Overfalls in Bavaria. He was executed September 5th, 1944. And he was executed via firing squad with a guard of honor after refusing to give any info. So they tortured him. They took everything away that they could from him. They threatened him with his life. He still wouldn't say anything.
Well, Mr. Biela, it appears our torture has been ineffective on you. Well, I respect you.
The big thing was he was killed by firing squad. Whereas in this concentration...
That doesn't seem like an honor guard thing to me.
Okay, so...
Give me a Mice and Men Lenny situation where he just... Let me hold a rabbit and then just dome me in the back of the skull.
So you could either be killed in this concentration camp via gas chamber or piano wire.
Oh, okay, so yeah, firing squad.
Yeah, okay. You're taking firing squad.
I did not know that any that was... Okay, I did not know that this what the other options were. Okay, yeah, I retract my statement.
But the Germans had so much respect for how good of a spy he was, they gave him a guard of honor with the firing squad. So, like, even they could game recognize game at that point. Like, hey, you sucked, you were on the other side, but you did a pretty fucking good job of being on the other side. So I don't know if I would call that a pat on the back, but... Beeler, the night before the D-Day invasion, him and his network went out, and what did they sprinkle on the train tracks?
I thought they just destroyed the train tracks.
There was some sort of an explosive that would cause derailments.
I'm not sure.
It was some sort of a powder or something like that that they would put on rail lines.
I know that they had a... This is going to sound crazy. They had an abrasive lubricant.
That's what it was. An abrasive lubricant, yes.
Okay, but they said that they would also do that and put that into machines and everything because it looked like oil or whatever they were using. But because it had the abrasive stuff in it, it would just wear down machinery. So they would use that to... I didn't know they used that on rail lines.
They said they would do it so is that wheels would go over the top of it. It would start wearing down on the wheels, and eventually it would get hot enough that it would start to melt into the track. Once that track melted, train would go off the tracks.
I know prior to, so the SOE was a huge part of D-Day, and we talked about that during the D-Day episodes about, like, you know, what was the counterintelligence? It was Fortitude. It was the counterintelligence.
Yep.
So prior to D-Day, and the BBC, actually, during the whole course of the war, because they were able to, their broadcast range was so large, they were broadcasting and could be heard on certain channels in almost all of the European countries. It was even illegal to listen to the BBC in a lot of areas. So they would actually send out coded messages just during regular broadcasts and everything, that if these agents and these resistance people knew what the cipher was or what the decryption was, they could actually get what the information was. Some of them were about people they had helped escape to if they actually returned to England and if they made it back. Others were timelines for certain missions that they needed to do. D-Day was a huge one when the BBC had sent out broadcast messages that were basically the week beforehand were like, okay, mobilize, this shit's getting ready to go down. The SOE was huge in the operations leading, you know, not only leading up to that, but during that week, organizing resistance and going out and basically for this week, getting ready to cause havoc in the 24 hours leading up to the invasion. I'm lowballing the number here, but just like kind of around in that 24 hours, they destroyed something like 200 railway networks or railway lines. So, and it was all around kind of the Normandy area or area to where the Germans would try to move via rail troops and equipment into those areas. So took out that.
If you've ever watched a train derailment too, pretty nuts.
I have never watched a train derailment.
It's a very aggressively scary looking affair.
They took out communication centers for the so the Germans couldn't communicate back and forth about the invasion. I want to say they also sabotaged. Oh, there was some other stuff that they did too. It might have been also some fuel depots.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, they were just causing as much fucking chaos and havoc as they could leading up to that.
Well, and the nice thing about destroying any sort of telecommunications as far as phone lines or anything like that was if you did that, we already had all of their coding decrypted. So they were...
We had decrypted the Enigma, or the Allies had, yeah.
They were forced to go over the radio waves, which they would be picked up on, and we would know the codes that they were speaking of. So instead of having just regular telephone lines to be able to make calls, they had to use the radio, which were going to be much easier to intercept those communications.
So what about Odette Howells?
Odette Howells Sansom. She was the most decorated spy during World War II. And just take a minute to sit on that for a second. She was the most decorated spy in World War II, male or female.
Like better than Garbo.
Yeah, that's...
decorated by which side? Because if it was decoration on the Nazi side, Garbo did get the Iron Cross from Hitler, so...
Yeah, but true.
You're talking Allied decoration.
I would say even all in total, because she was honored with, and we'll talk about it, an English Medal of Honor. She was also given a French Medal of Honor for her work inside of France.
Okay, there are two countries.
Yeah.
There you go.
Not the two countries that are fighting.
But. Exactly. So, yeah, actually just one country because the other one didn't count. Yeah.
Yeah. But she was a native French woman. Not Frenchman. French woman.
Yeah.
And
French person.
She was found because, as we were talking about earlier, when England was like, hey, send us pictures of the coastline. We would love to see it. She sent in a bunch of pictures, and she also said that she wanted to help them, teach French to people. Mm-hmm. Any way that she could help, she wanted to help. And when they saw the pictures, they were like, she looks exactly like a French woman. Are you from France? She's like, born and raised. That's where I've been my whole entire life. Yeah. And so they brought her in. And as they were training her, there were questions about how good she would be with the SOE. She started out as just a first aid nursing for, I think they're called the Yeomanry, and they worked with the SOE, but she was considered way too impulsive to be an agent. She didn't really care about her life too much, which sounds like a good thing for these people, but also she's going to be so reckless that she's going to put everybody else's lives at danger.
Exactly, yeah. She essentially has other people's lives in her hands.
But after she went through training, her training officer said that she was the most apt spy that had ever gone through his training. And they're like, you have to put her in the field. You have to get her over there. She attempted to get into France 5 different times. she actually didn't get flown into France. She got taken in by boat because on one of her last training jumps, she fucked up her ankle pretty good. Mm. So they weren't going to put her back up in the air to try it again.
What are you going to do if you hurt even more? Then you're walking around with a fresh injury. You're new to the area.
Yeah.
You can't run if you want.
So they got her in on a night landing. One of the other times that she was like seconds away from getting on a plane to be sent over, they had gotten word that the network that they were sending her into had been compromised, and there were something like 200 agents that had been unmasked by the Germans. So they weren't going to send her there, which probably pretty lucky.
Yeah.
But once she finally gets there, she ends up working with a guy, no relation. His name was Peter Churchill, and he was kind of like the network head. She was initially going over there to do something completely different, but Peter had asked, I guess he became fairly infatuated with her, and he had asked for her to be sent to
a French spy with nothing to lose.
Yeah.
Yeah. How?
It's every Englishman's dream.
I'm no kidding.
She ended up being his courier, and the courier that she took over for had lost another list of agents. So they were kind of working.
She's like, I'm not on any of these fucking lists, right? Yeah. These are all not up-to-date lists.
But they had placed her under Churchill. She was put in, what was it? It was called the Spindle Network. And she was in a town called Marseille. And Marseille had already been infiltrated by German agents and mm-hmm. was like a hotbed for German spies. So she has to be double careful because she still needs to be working as a courier going in and out of these networks that may have already been exposed. They don't know which agents were exposed. But then there was also confirmation that there were German agents working in there too. So she, everywhere that she looked, she had to question everybody that she saw. That didn't really work out great. Churchill and Sansom ended up being arrested. Part of their network was they had to keep up a public appearance that they were together. Mm-hmm. So when they would be going out into the countryside to spot these areas where they were going to do drops or anything like that, they had to play up the romance that then turned into an actual romance. And they made a couple of escapes as they were being basically hunted by the Gestapo, and they were arrested at a hotel in St. Horos. Don't know if that's the correct pronunciation, by Italian soldiers, and then turned over to the Gestapo. They were taken to a prison. Shit, what was it? French prison.
Is Marseille done around like southern France?
I think it is.
Okay, because that the SOE also, like, anyone that was operating kind of in, like, Italy and the Mediterranean, they would be in communication with Cairo, the SOE office in Cairo.
Really?
So, yeah. Damn. So I would assume that if they're more in southern France and they're closer to that area, then they're probably trying to work their way down to get to okay. that. Yeah.
During these interrogations at this French prison, she was interrogated 14 times. During these 14 times that she was interrogated, her back was repeatedly stabbed by a red-hot poker, and she had had all of her toenails removed, which doesn't... The one toenail removed sounds awful, but to know that that was the first
one... That's like the bamboo shoots going in the fingernails.
Yeah. You know that you're going to be feeling that 9 more times. And for her to be able to not crack and not say anything, I think they kind of knew, like, oh, shit. This is a pretty big deal. This woman's not going to crack. She was sentenced to death on 2 counts in June 1943. When she was sentenced to death, this is how calculated this woman was, and this is how awesome she was where is it? Oh, this was her response when she was condemned to death for these 2 counts. She goes, then you will have to make up your mind on which count I am to be executed because I can only die once.
Ooh.
Pretty cool spy saying.
Except she said it in French.
That's even hotter.
And then she spit on the ground.
Excuse me. So, after that, she got her death sentence. She was sent into a place called Ravensbrück, a concentration camp that was in Germany. After the Allied landings in August 44... she was isolated and starved for, I believe it was 3 weeks. She was taken away. She was put in a cell that didn't get any light. She was denied food for 3 weeks. She ends up surviving all the way through that. She was then moved to an isolated cell that was near the crematorium, where she said that...
Not a place you want to get closer to.
No, no. She said that she would, unfortunately, there would be hair from the crematorium that would blow into her cell on windy days. It's pretty fucking scary. Luckily for her, the Allies were moving towards starting to liberate these camps. They were on their way to Ravensbrück when the camp commandant, French Schurin, loaded her up into a car and drove her to the Americans on the hopes that if he gave her... or gave them to her and then surrendered himself, they wouldn't kill him.
Yeah. So this isn't just a French woman. This is like a spy. This is an ally spy.
Well, and she also believed that she was treated a little bit differently because they knew that her and Churchill were involved. And she had told them that Peter Churchill was Winston Churchill's nephew.
Ooh.
So essentially, name drop. Yeah, maybe trying to use bargaining chips.
Like if they find out any of you had anything to do with killing me?
Yeah.
You know, not just starving me for 3 weeks, but actually killing me? Ooh.
That angry drunk back in England is really going to ruin me.
He does not like you to start with, guys.
No, but she survived all the way through being starved in these prison camps, in these concentration camps, where thousands and thousands of people had died. She actually made it all the way through. She's awarded something called the George Cross for her efforts. It's the highest British award for non-operational bravery. So, like, not an operation.
Sounds like an operation to me.
Well, that's the kind of tricky thing with spies, is they are on an operation, but it's not a military operation because it's so secretive. She was also, like I said, it was the Fleur de something French was the award that she gotten over back in France for bravery for her work in France. And all in all, for her to be able to live through all that and tell the tale is the exact reason why they were so concerned about her being an SOE agent in the beginning, because she was reckless. She didn't give a fuck. She didn't care if she lived or died, and she fought all the way to the end. She was starved for, I don't know if you've ever thought about not eating for 3 weeks.
No, I get angry. I get upset if I don't eat multiple times a day.
Yeah. So to think that she was able to live through that and just all the mental torture of the hot poker and getting the taking of the toenails. I got nothing
on this French broad.
She's a tough, tough woman. I think she did finally die, though. So I would assume at this point.
Well, yeah. I mean, as most people who participated in that era.
Hey, man, she skirted a lot of death before that.
So before we get to this operation here, which is kind of like the one of the most well-known ones that has been released at the SOE, is I want to, because this is a real operation, there was one that was planned that actually didn't end up happening, but had it happened, oh baby. Did you read about Operation Foxley?
Mm-mm.
So Operation Foxley was the plan to assassinate Hitler.
Oh, yes. Okay.
So during the Normandy invasion, they had actually, one of the soldiers, the German soldiers that was taken prisoner, had been in the personal guard for Hitler down in Berchtesgaden, the Ober Salzburg, where he had his like summer home.
The nest?
The Eagle's Nest was the one that was up in the, up on that peak of the mountain.
In the Alps?
Yeah, but the house was in the town below it. I can't remember what they called it. So it was planned. He knew the details of what it would like look like and what would be happening if Hitler was there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that would happen is if Hitler was visiting his home there, they would be flying a Nazi flag down in the village where he could see it from the house. Or maybe you could see it, the one on his house, from the village down below.
It makes sense.
Either or. So there was that guy's uncle happened to be like extremely anti-Nazi that lived down in kind of like near one of those villages. So a couple teams were trained, and basically this guy and then what would be like his companion, like his traveling companion, maybe a spotter. I think the guy was actually French, or not French, might have been kind of German speaking from that area.
Mm-hmm.
He went with him, and this guy had trained to use, they'd gotten German uniforms. He had trained to use the German Kar 98, which was like the standard infantry rifle with like a scope on it, and was able to like, they did mock, you know, where he was moving and everything, and was able to essentially at an acceptable range, being able to hit these targets. They trained because this guy had provided information that around 10 o'clock in the morning, Hitler would go on these walks. And he would not take his guards with him because he was just walking around his property and there were woods all around.
Yeah.
It got to the point where they actually, I think they dropped these guys in, or they got close to dropping him in. 5 days later, when they had the go-ahead for this, maybe they didn't end up dropping him in, was when the attempt in the Wolf's Lair happened.
So we got one of our assassination attempts canceled because the Nazis were trying to assassinate Adolf themselves.
Because they couldn't do, they were the closest ones to him and they couldn't fucking pull it off. All right, so Operation Grouse is kind of like part one of a three-part series of operations that the SOE pulls off, attempts to pull off.
The overarching operation was called Operation Freshman. They'd heard through a guy named, I don't know if it was through him, but a gentleman named Einar Skinnerland And Einar Skinnerland was a Norwegian engineer that was recruited because he'd worked at this place called the Mostavon Dam. And he came over. You and I have talked about this in the beginning of just kind of our research, but there's so many things that get lost in thinking about war where I didn't really realize, but it just kind of has to be this way, that even if you're an occupied country, you still have to go to work.
Yeah, you're just under new management.
Yeah.
You still have to go about daily business because they want your company to be operational so they can take your shit and the country still runs.
It's just a completely foreign concept to think, like, if America, I guess we're actively at war pretty much all the time, but
yeah,
if we had a home front war, I wouldn't want to go into work that day, but unfortunately I still have to. Like, we still have to keep up this facade.
People going to work at McDonald's, people going to work to sell furniture, uh-huh. People still happen to do the shit, and it's just, it is kind of crazy to think about.
So this Einar guy had a bunch of vacation time saved up, and this is where this whole idea just becomes crazy to me. He takes 3 weeks of vacation. He makes his way into England, and he is debriefed. And he gives them basically the layout of this water plant that is up in the mountains where he says that the Germans are producing something called heavy water.
Now, I had to look this up because I'm like, I know just from like having done World War II research that the whole thread of this is that heavy water is a key component in actually trying to make and create an atomic bomb. It was part of the plan of the German atomic, you know, weapons program to utilize this stuff. So heavy water occurs naturally in nature. However, it's in very small quantities. Well, if you're processing it through a plant, you can gather larger quantities. When heavy water is applied to U-238, so it would be the uranium-238, mm-hmm. It allows U-238 to undergo fission, which if you've listened to the Oppenheimer episode, you know that that's what essentially creates the explosive blast that creates an atomic bomb. So if this kind of sounds familiar, if you've ever played Battlefield, there is an entire campaign that takes place.
Call of Duty or Battlefield?
It's Battlefield.
Okay.
And it takes place during one of these missions in which they have to infiltrate this heavy water plant, the SOE, and essentially demolish it and then get the fuck out. And Operation Grouse, essentially, they were going to use gliders and bring in, you know, you have to have a tow plane, everything. So a bomber would tow them to a certain point, release them, and then an operations team would glide in. And I believe they were going to be the ones that had to climb the ice wall, or were they going to be skiing down the mountain?
Oh, we're too far ahead.
Okay.
We got to lay the groundwork to this. All right, because this is an incredible feat that I don't know how these SOE agents survived. But Einar heads his way to England, gets debriefed, tells them about this heavy water plant. They decide that they need to do something about this because the Germans are making steps towards atomic weaponry. Mm-hmm. So Einar lays out like the entire blueprints of this water treatment plant to the point to where the commandos that go in, their road's blocked. But since their road is blocked to get inside, the blueprints that he had given them were so detailed that they said when they were inside the water treatment plant, they felt like they had been there before. Mm-hmm. It was that good.
Well, so, of course, they had designed something for them to train in and everything.
So Einar's 3 weeks of vacation are up. They bring him back in. They parachute him back into Norway. He just goes back to work. Like, he just spent this 3 week vacation telling the British how to blow up this heavy water plant in Norway. Then they just send his ass parachuting back into Norway and he goes into work the next day. Mm-hmm. Talk about a crazy ass vacation that you'd have to spend. So, their next plan was on, and this is where dates are huge. And remember, this is Norway. So the first team is dropped in Norway, October 18th, 1942, at a place called Fjørfit.
Sounds good. I got to paint the picture of this place.
Okay.
This thing looks like, this is a water processing plant. This thing looks like the lair of a fucking Bond villain or like an evil superhero or something like that. It's basically in the mountains, but it's also perched atop like two sides of it are like a cliff going down. completely covered in ice and snow. And then you just see this cluster of lights, and it's this industrial concrete, like three or four story building. It's huge.
After they were dropped in there, I believe it was four agents that started out, four SOE agents that were dropped in. They spent the next 15 days trekking to Mostovan outside of the water treatment plant, far enough away that they wouldn't be found. But 15 days of trekking through Norway in October sounds like a hell of a deal. London made the preparations to drop these commandos a part of Operation Grouse. And once they made contact that they were in Mostovan, they decided it was time to go. There were two gliders that were scheduled to land 3.1 miles or 5 kilometers away from Norsk Hydro Plant, which is this hydro plant that they need to hit. November 19th, even though there wasn't good weather, they decided to take a risk and send the glider. The first glider, as it's coming through, there's so much rain in the air, there's so much moisture in the air, that the connection point between the plane and the glider freezes over. And the plane is taking on so much ice along with the glider that it's actually sinking. So they're about to drop it. The connection just breaks in between the glider and the plane. Glider's thrown completely off course. It ends up crashing. It crashes with 17 people on board and three were killed. German soldiers arrived the next day and just basically rounded them up.
Yeah.
So that's how dangerous this was, that the crash happened overnight. And by the next day, there were already German soldiers that were going to mop everybody up. If that wasn't a bad sign of things to come, the second glider is sent up after that. I think it was a matter of like a day or two after, maybe a couple days to kind of clear the air. Second glider ends up crashing as well, kills two. 18 of them were injured. The 18 that were injured, they had crashed near sort of like a village, to where they could go in and make contact with these people. They were saying, hey, we're here to liberate you guys. We're here to help you out. We're against the Germans. We need your help. They said, well, the next doctor is a radio call away. We can make that happen, but unfortunately the Germans are on the radio wave, so they can hear anything about it. They surmised that the risk was great enough to still call over the radio to get a hold of the doctor, that they were hoping that the doctors would be able to make it there before the Germans and fix everybody up.
Trying to probably be sly about it, being like, yeah, we need the doctor right now. And if it sounds suspicious, all like, why are they calling for a doctor? We know just that there was a mission and we just captured a bunch of guys, so be on the lookout for anything, investigate anything suspicious.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the Germans beat the doc there, and all of the survivors were executed by the Germans up on the mountain. And they had to really take a step back and look at it. And this is all not including the four that were dropped in Norway before that did all the trekking. Those were the landing party crew that were going to be there to help out the commandos once they got there.
They were basically scouting it to make sure that, like, they knew the patterns of the guards. Mm-hmm. They knew everything about it. So when it came time for the strike to happen, it was just like, this is when it needs to happen. Here's the time. All of the reconnaissance and research had already been done on it.
Well, and they were standing where these landings of these gliders were supposed to happen, but since they were both blown off course or they were released too early, they never knew what happened. So they were just probably standing in their field with the dick in their hands, like, where's the glider? Mm-hmm. Oh, shit, the glider's not here. They said it was supposed to be here. And so these guys, and again, this is what's shocking to me. Norway, they land in October. Operation Gunnerside, where they send in the Norwegian commandos, doesn't take place until February 16th, 1943.
You got to give it time to cool down, because it was November but when they did it the first time.
These guys lived in the mountains of Norway through the winter time and were able to survive on what rations they had just gotten the first time.
I mean, I'm sure they did some hunting and stuff, and they might have had some help from some locals.
They couldn't give themselves away to any of the locals. So they were just up on a mountain. They had one hut that they were staying in. They had one guy that was the best skier. He went out and would ski around and try to find different lodges up in the mountains that may have had food. The other guy was, they had one other guy that was like an expert hunter, and he would go out and try to get a meat. And they said December 23rd, he ran across a flock of reindeer and took his first shot and missed, took his second shot and hit. And they brought the reindeer back to the hut that they were living in, and they had a reindeer feast for Christmas, and they actually turned on the radio to Radio 1 and, like, listened to hymns as they ate up in this just old mountain compound.
Well, Operation Gunnerside, they're like, you know what? We've sent in the British commandos. let's send in the home team. So they actually landed 6 Norwegian commandos. Again, you have all these people coming over from occupied territories. Guess what? A lot of them were people that had probably served in the military that came over, and a lot of them that want to go back and fucking take their countries back. So these Norwegian commandos successfully land on February 16th. So the assault on the plan after they met up with these 4 initial guys, kind of like the scouting party, it was planned to assault the plant. Essentially, they were going to sneak in there, and the goal was to sneak in completely undetected, unseen, plant the demolition charges, and get the fuck out. So that was planned for the night of February 27th and 28th. They were blocked crossing by a bridge. So the way it was set up is the main road coming in, because again, it was on this little like rock outcropping. The gorge of the cliff that was kind of cut back in toward the hill and separated the fucking road from getting in there. So there was literally one entry point as far as the road goes, and it was this bridge that dropped 660 feet into this ravine. And then you would have to climb back up almost kind of like an ice wall, because it was that steep, up to the plant. Well, that's what they ended up fucking doing. They're like, we can't get over the bridge, so I guess we're climbing.
Yeah, the bridge is too highly guarded, so we're going to drop 660 feet and then climb up 660 feet to get in there.
In order for them to get up the mountain and then try to come back down that way, probably would have taken too much time. Plus, if the Germans are protecting the bridge, they probably have probably not as heavy of security.
Yeah.
But it's probably still, they're like, okay, this is the most likely point someone would have to come in. What's the second most likely? Probably down the hill. They're not going to expect someone to fucking go down in this ravine and climb up.
No.
Where there's not even, when you look at a picture, it looks like the building is just built right up against the cliff face. I'm sure there was a walkway and everything, but you don't have any of the searchlights and the guards and the fucking dogs and everything like that just patrolling around.
Well, you're doing it too with all the equipment that you have to bring in to get in, and then the detonation devices, all that shit. What machine gun did the English use?
They used a couple, but are you thinking of the one that they provided a lot to the French resistance was the, I literally just looked it up. Come back to me.
Okay. That'll come into play later, but they climb back up this ravine. They end up getting inside to the plant. They place the explosive on the heavy water chambers. They set the detonation device for 2 minutes before they actually click them in to give them the
Sten.
The
Sten?
Yeah.
It was the one that they could mass produce. It was super easy. If you've ever seen a video, it's the one that has the clip that loads in from the side.
Well, they said that they had left one in the hydro plant. So when they came in to investigate what happened, they would see this British gun in there, and they would know that it wasn't the Norwegians that did it. They would know that it was the English arm or the British army.
Wasn't that meant to, because a lot of these situations when they had done operations in France throughout these other areas, the local populace, because they were essentially hidden still, it's not like they're a moving force that they can identify. They would do these operations, and then the Germans would come in and assume these local populace had helped them. And in certain circumstances, they actually wiped out like 2 villages. That was the operation that I was thinking of. So back, I think, a little bit before the Norwegian one. Let's talk about this one, then I'll talk about the
Okay. So they plant the charges. They're ready to go. They're getting ready to set off these detonations in order for them to be able to get out safely before it happens. One of the guys that was in charge of setting the detonations refused to leave until he found the glasses that he had left, like his reading glasses, essentially, or his seeing glasses. So they searched and searched and searched before they had set these timers to go off on these bombs that they had strapped to these heavy water tanks. And looked around, couldn't find them. The guy's like, I'm not leaving without my glasses. And then he reaches up and feels that they're still on his head.
Jesus.
So drops his glasses back down. They set the detonators on these things. They get the fuck out. They detonate. And I want to say they said that it blew up like 6,000 gallons. It was like 40% of their heavy water reserves.
It literally set their program back at that point too, because this took place in 43. It set them back because, again, this is at a time when also it looks like the tide, you know, they're getting pushed a little bit. Russia's not going too well. It's not like they can just rededicate a ton of resources back to this.
No.
And all of that that they've spent this time producing is gone.
Yeah.
So to build up again that additional, because they weren't even at that point where they had enough to really do anything or succeed with it. So to lose that much and then try to build that back up again without a functional plant that was one of your sole, you know, sources of this stuff. Yeah. It's not going to happen.
We also didn't talk about it mainly because I had forgotten until you just brought that up. Part of the reason why these commandos went in was because the English were like, fuck it. Why do we need to do that? We'll just bomb them. And Einar, the guy that came down and laid everything out, is like, no, these holding tanks that they have this water, this heavy water in, are so fortified that there's no way that you could ever bomb them.
The other thing, too, is it's this sole place up in the mountains.
Yeah.
For the height that you would have to be bombing from. That's the big thing, too, is one of the reasons the SOE actually kind of talked its way into existence was when the RAF was bombing, it was like strategic bombing, but you would do a lot of collateral damage to the area around it. You were dropping entire, just like you're, you know, when you're dropping your bombs, if you're looking at these bomber formations, also everybody check out the new show on HBO. What's it? Or no, on Apple TV, yes. Masters of the Air. Mm-hmm. It's fucking phenomenal. But you have these formations of planes where they're spread out over hundreds of yards and they're all dropping at the same time in hopes that a couple of those planes hit the target. So you're hitting collateral damage to all that area. One of the proponents that they were saying the SOE could do is they could do the damage to these places that they were intending to do, but without any of the collateral damage. Mm-hmm. And if you do enough collateral damage, guess what? You're going to lose support of the populace.
Oh, yeah.
And your resistant networks and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, if you wipe out a village of 1,000 people, but you blow up the plant, there's going to be some people angry about the 1,000 people that you just wiped out.
Yeah, they're going to be a lot less likely to help you.
So after these detonations went off, they blew these tanks, and the commandos and the four that initially landed skied over 200 miles.
Cross-country and downhill.
Yep. 322 kilometers to safety in Sweden. Then after they got to Sweden, they made their way through the escape lines and ended up getting back to England. But after you get through all that shit and you do the bombing and everything's successful, then you got to strap the skis on and go for 200 miles.
Now you got to get the fuck out.
Yeah. And to their credit, they did it, which is absolutely incredible that they could, just like you said, with the way that that power plant was set up, the fact that they could get people in safely, get them into the plant safely, successfully complete their mission, and then get them out is without losing anybody, besides all the people that died in the other hang glider accidents.
Well, and it was, I don't know if it was a few months later or a little while later, but in Norway, they were also trying to transport like what a portion of the remaining stock of heavy water via like a barge or like a ship and everything. And I think it was Norwegian resistance actually was able to bomb and blow up the ship and sink that all the way down to the bottom of whatever fjord it was traveling through. So another big knock. One of the things that the SOE did do was the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich. And Reinhard was the commander of the German Reich Security Main Office. He was the acting governor of what they considered the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia.
Pretty high up.
He was also a principal architect to the Holocaust.
Really high up.
Yep. So essentially this operation was called Operation Anthropoid. It was carried out by resistance operators Josip Gabčík and Jan Kubis. They were actually trained by the SOE and then sent back to try to accomplish this mission. So what they basically did is they were equipped with like machine guns and I think some grenades dropped into the area. They learned about his route that he took in his car. He only traveled with a driver and they found a spot where he would have to slow down, but it was far enough between checkpoints that they could try to perform the assassination and try to get away. Well, he ends up getting stopped by these guys because, again, they were dressed as German officers. I think they were looking to, they were going and asking him for his papers. And one of the guys stands out to shoot. And I think the driver turned to fire. He ends up firing back. The other guy's gun jammed. And then one of them throws a grenade at the car. It actually goes in the car and explodes. Heydrich is able to get out. The driver gets out. One of the assassins is killed. But the end result of this is that Heydrich ends up dying 7 days later from the injuries that he got from the shrapnel.
And the one SOE agent that made it out didn't know that they'd completed their mission until he got back and got debriefed. So to think that that could have been a massive failure and that that didn't work, and then you get back and like, hey, man, great job killing that guy.
That's the one, though, that I was kind of touching base on when I was mentioning like the destruction of the villages and mass killings of civilians. there was some huge reprisal by SS troops because of this, that they took out a lot of the surrounding, the people in the surrounding area.
If we know anything about the Germans, they don't ever punish the people that actually did the crimes.
It's the people around where the crime was committed, it seems like. Yeah.
Or not the Germans, the Nazis.
But, yeah, I mean, we could literally talk about the different operations. There were a ton of operations, like, over in China and in the Pacific. These guys were doing anything and everything pretty much in every theater of war. And it's crazy to think about, like, how also kind of, like, wide stretch this was. Not only was it assassinations, it was sabotage, blowing up railways, creating resistance movements, leading spy networks, women in there, you know, also doing their part. We didn't even touch on the fact that a lot of, like, they would hire prostitutes.
Yeah.
And get prostitutes to start working, because guess what? Where are all those German soldiers going and spending their money when they're in France?
Got to catch a nut somewhere.
They would even actually send them, or when they came to be debriefed, they would get them lingerie in Britain and send back with them to be more enticing and to be able to seduce more of these officers. So nothing's off the table. And I'm here for it.
You got to be bummed if you're a prostitute and you get back to freedom and you get debriefed. Like, good news, bad news. Good news is you're working for us. Bad news, we're sending you back over there to get fucked. But then you do the good news, Nazis.
We bought you some new clothes. So you do, it's the shit sandwich. You do the shit sandwich approach. Well, come the end of the war.
This bums me out.
I know. The SOE is officially dissolved in January of 46. One of your nicknames is Churchill's Secret Army, as soon as Winston is out of office in 1945, probably a lot of stuff that has to do with Winston is going to be on the chopping block. It was the other party that actually won. It wasn't someone running against Winston in his own party.
It's like the British party Labour won. Party.
Huh?
I think it was the British Labour Party, maybe.
Yeah. And so, you know, you're also going from wartime into peacetime. You're trying to revert back to a peacetime economy, trim some of the fat. So a lot of the things that took place and what the SOE kind of paved the way for, that was just integrated into things like MI6 and the SIS. So, you know, it's not like it went away. It was essentially just kind of like broken up and then absorbed into other agencies.
Yeah, they just shuffled the deck a little bit and they kept some of the stuff that they like. The main part that bums me out was, I guess I can see it after doing our Churchill episode, and I'm sure we talked about it during that episode, is Churchill just brought you through the bloodiest war that anybody could have ever imagined. Mm-hmm. And you wanted him at the helm that whole time because Neville Chamberlain kowtowed to the Germans. But once you got out of the war, you just didn't trust this batshit crazy leader to be able to fix your economy.
His gift was leading the people through fucking dark times. And when you also got to think too, like, it, do you also then envision that person as, you know, like a relic of the war? Or when you think of them and you think of that, you're like, I think we need something new with this war being over. We got to go a different direction. I mean, I'm sure there was no shortage of ammunition against Churchill, essentially, yeah, during that election. But to me, Winston Churchill just has to get up there and be like, we're all not speaking German.
Yeah.
Who do you think was a big, huge part of that, just with two thumbs aimed back at himself?
What's the reason I'm standing here in front of you guys today?
Mm-hmm.
Me.
Yeah, you're not all holding your arms up in the air toward a fucking lectern with some fucking tiny mustachioed man just screaming at you the entire time. But for what they did within that, fuck, 6-year period, that's pretty nuts, man.
Well, and I'm sure we got to talk about another episode about their, just these different theaters that they were in. Because like you said, they were everywhere that was occupied, and everything was sort of a different fight. This was the European theater, kind of mainly surrounding the European theater, and that was sort of a battlefield. Like you were saying earlier, you could blend in because everybody kind of looks alike. But when you go over to the Pacific theater and you're going along Malay and everywhere in there, and you have your British holdings that you've had, your colonialism that spread that far, French colonialism that spread that far over there. After France falls, Japan moves in and starts sucking up everything in Asia. You have the war that's going on in China.
I didn't realize this. Did you know Malaysia was supplying like 40% of like the rubber and tin?
Yeah.
For the fucking world?
That to me seems like a whole lot. I don't know if we had come up with like lab created rubber. I don't know what it's called. Manufactured
synthetic
rubber.
Synthetic rubber,
yeah. Yes. But I think part of synthetic rubber going into things is also natural rubber being added to it as well. So 40% is a massive holding that you're going to have on the world's economy and the world's ability to build war machines to fight against you.
All right, guys. Well, there was one mission we didn't cover, but you're going to go ahead and see the Ministry of Ungentlemanly, was it warfare?
I believe so.
And that covers a mission in which a team of SOE operatives, I think it's inspired by the mission. Again, it's Guy Ritchie movie. It's going to be fucking fantastic. It's probably not going to be extremely historically accurate.
Nah.
But in which they had to actually like steal a few like ships from like either Spain or like German ships that were in like Spanish territory, something like that. Listen, Guy, you want to come on the podcast, talk a little bit about history. You did King Arthur, I believe. So obviously you are interested in history. If Henry Cavill wants to go ahead and come on the podcast, talk about that. I know he's
not about your religion, just about the
any of those guys. You guys hear this and want to come on this podcast, go ahead and send us a little drop. We'd be more than happy to have you on.
Open invitation. We'll come to you if we have to.
There you go. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us on this one. You got anything else, buddy?
No, I think we're good. I think this is a nice little teaser for more of these to come.
Oh, hell yeah. All right. We'll catch you guys on the next one. Have a good one.
Peace.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us for another episode. If you like what you heard, hit that subscribe and like button. Follow us. If you didn't like what you heard, still hit that anyway, because we'll probably cover something in the future that you do like. Please follow us on our social media. Adam, hit them with it.
Our Instagram is historically high pod, historically high POD, and we are on Twitter at historically high, that's historically HI.
All right. And if you guys want to send in any feedback, suggestions, hit us up on those two, or you can even do it on Gmail. It's historicallyhighpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again.
Peace.